Drive Time on BCFM. 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with our Police and Crime Commissioner candidates, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, and me, Tony Gosling. We'll be back with the candidates in a minute, but first, Martin, a quick run through some of the big stories of the week. The big national story is David Cameron and the government's defeat over the EU budget freeze. We've got a couple of headlines, one from The Guardian saying Cameron's stance could force Britain out of the EU, claims Clegg, and the Daily Mail is saying the tide is turned against Europe's dictatorial arrogance. Mr Cameron can swim with it and be a hero or go under. That's the Daily Mail. What are your thoughts about this one? Because we had a strange situation with lots of backbench Conservative MPs voting right alongside the Labour Party.
Yes, I must admit I was somewhat surprised by this turn of events. I presume what the Labour Party are trying to do is start a squabble within the coalition between the Liberal Democrats and the Tory Party. So they don't believe in increasing the EU budget and want it to be reduced, apparently. But I think there are many people in the Labour Party who are pro-EU who weren't very happy with being whipped into the lobby alongside the Tory Eurosceptics. But what we're seeing is a lot of squabbling, really. The euro and the European Union are becoming major issues, and I think what we actually need is a bit of coordination across Europe, and we need to get rid of this austerity policy, but that's not really what we're talking about.
A lot of the people in the discussion in the Commons were talking about whether or not it was fair to increase the budget or even keep it level when Britain is having to go through cuts. So let's go now to the debate on Wednesday in the House of Commons and have a listen to the EU, this is the EU debate, Labour's Shadow Treasury Minister, Chris Leslie, and then after that, the Conservative Conor Burns.
In a week when a million letters are being sent clawing back child benefit, when police budgets are being cut by 20%, when pensioners are having their tax allowances frozen, it's a fact, and when some of the poorest in society are being asked to pay more in tax, it's a fact, wouldn't it be perverse if the European Union were exempt from those cuts?
How can we go back to our constituencies and look our electors in the eye who are paying hugely more for petrol, for food, for rail fares? This House, Mr Speaker, matters again. We have the opportunity as a united House of Commons to back the Prime Minister, to send a clear signal, to send him emboldened into the Council of Europe with a clear message from the British House of Commons and from the British people that enough is enough.
So, yes, that was Conservative Conor Burns you heard there, and before him, Labour's Shadow Treasury Minister, Chris Leslie. Martin, this is a bit of a running sore in the Conservative Party Europe, isn't it? Because it seems that half, if not more than half, of his party actually don't appreciate paying money to Brussels when we're having to make cutbacks at home.
Well, the issue is cutbacks at home and cutbacks in the EU. The policy of austerity being pursued by the British government and by the major European countries is completely counterproductive. What we're going to find as we go forward is that a result of the austerity policies being pursued on this side of the channel and on the other side of the channel, we're going to have a banking collapse. And then, of course, everybody is going to be unemployed as a result of that. There's not, from my point of view, enough seriousness about the economic crisis. All of this squabbling about whether we're in or out of the EU, frankly, is fiddling while Rome burns. There's about to be a banking collapse and possibly a Middle East war that will blow away all of this parochial parish pump politics.
Another news story this week, Northern Ireland prison officer was shot dead yesterday morning on a motorway ambush. David Black, who worked in the Northern Ireland Prison Service for more than 30 years and was nearing retirement, was shot dead on the M1 between Lurgan and Portadown in County Armagh. The father of two is the first prison officer to be murdered by paramilitaries since 1993, and it came out also yesterday afternoon that he was in the Orange Order.
Yeah, well, up to now, the Republican dissidents have been attacking police officers of nationalist origin, Catholic origin, like Ronnie O'Carroll. And this attack on a loyalist prison officer is an escalation, because it could be perceived in the loyalist community as a sectarian attack. But I think the good news in this rather sad event is that all of the serious political forces in Northern Ireland, including Sinn Féin, have completely condemned the killing, and they've referred to it as futile and pointless, and that it is, because the peace process is absolutely solid, and people who attempt to derail it with these acts of violence will not succeed.
So is this real Republican dissidents, or is this someone from outside? Well, any ideas coming in?
As you probably know, Tony, people within the mainstream Republican movement, Sinn Féin, regard these dissidents as potentially being manipulated by British intelligence. But I don't think we need to actually go into a level of conspiracy theory about this. Everybody has condemned the killing. It's wrong. And of course, the Republican dissidents have got some prisoners in Magherbury prison where the guy worked, and so we could see a spiral back to where we were during the hunger strike, where prison officers were being assassinated and prisoners were being abused inside the H blocks. But I think all of the politicians in Northern Ireland and most of the people are determined that that's not going to happen.
The Japanese are to build a £700 million UK nuclear power plant, or they're spending that amount of money on our plants anyway. Hitachi, their deal will provide energy for 14 million homes for 60 years, apparently. They are moving in to take up where the Chinese have pulled out to build nuclear power stations, it seems, in Gloucestershire, that's at Oldbury, and also Anglesey in North Wales.
Yes, I mean, this is another bone of contention within the coalition. The Conservatives, by and large, tend to be in favour of having nuclear power. The Liberals are opposed to it. The Liberals thought they had an agreement that there would be no nuclear power if it involved any kind of public subsidy. I still believe, basically, that nuclear power is uneconomic, and without public subsidy, I don't think this stuff is going to go ahead. They are basically touting for business and hoping they're going to get away with it.
One of the things that's frustrated me in a lot of the national coverage of this story is nobody seems to be saying, well, I mean, nuclear is finished in Japan, so these companies are now looking for somewhere else to build their plants.
Absolutely, and what you've got when you've got an industry like nuclear power, think of all the money and time and capital invested over the years in Japan, and you then have to go and sell nuclear power, a bit like pyramid selling heroin. And the French nuclear power industry is in a similar position. They've committed themselves to nuclear power generations ago, and the only way to get some of the money back, you're losing a fortune, the only way to get some of the money back is to sell on to others. And that's what's keeping the nuclear power industry going, is the fact that there's such a massive infrastructure around it, and some of the money has to be recouped somehow, so they just try and sell it to others. But I think basically nuclear power has demonstrated over the years to be completely uneconomic.
Okay, moving abroad to Tunisia, they've extended the state of emergency in Tunisia. Tunisia is significant because it was the first country to go through an uprising as part of the Arab Spring. That state of emergency, which is supposed to be being renewed every month, is now being extended right up until January for several months.
Well, I wouldn't like to comment too much about what's going on in Tunisia. I've not followed it that closely. I'm aware of the changes have taken place. I think what we're seeing is the Arab Spring of 18 months ago turning into the Arab nightmare in places like Syria and Iraq.
Well, one of the main problems in Tunisia was that actually, even after they'd had their elections last year, some very popular parties. One was a party which was their leader had come to London from Tunisia in exile and was running a TV channel that literally millions of people in Tunisia were watching this. And when he stood for election, his votes were then discounted. The candidates weren't allowed to actually become part of the government.
Well, what you've got in all of these countries is very, very controlled democratic experiments. The military are still pretty much in charge in Egypt, as far as I can see. And we saw, very interestingly, the Emir of Qatar, who's definitely been pushing a revolution in Syria, turning up in Gaza a couple of weeks ago. I think the real danger in the Middle East now, we've seen, is also in Lebanon, where there's been an attempt to remove the democratically elected government because it's not pro-Western and it isn't in favour of intervention in Syria. There's a real danger that we're going to have a major Middle East war dragging in the Kurds, Eastern Turkey, Lebanon, Iraq still imploding. The Sunni terrorists who are trying to destabilise the government in Iraq are exactly the same kind of people who are trying to overthrow the government of Syria. It's not black and white, and the danger is that this is all going to spoil over and turn into a major war, which will, of course, whack up the oil price and really finish off the euro and the banking system.
Okay, so on to the US elections then at the beginning of next week. What happens if the American election ends in a draw is the question the BBC asked. What are your thoughts about one way or the other, Martin, and particularly with the effect on other parts of the world, like the tensions in the Middle East with either Romney or Obama being elected?
Well, this is another factor leading to instability. I suspect we're going to have a photo finish. And I've been reading all sorts of things which suggest that there's going to be all sorts of cheating, that electronic votes are not going to be secure, as they haven't been in the past in the US. If people check the details, they will see that the 2004 election, there was an enormous amount of cheating and voter suppression and potential hacking of electronic voting machines. And I think there's a real danger that you will end up with a prolonged period of instability in the US, which will, of course, also add to the further instability in Europe and the Middle East. I mean, it's not looking good from any of these perspectives.
Talking about election fraud, we have to be vigilant here in Britain too, because we've had, certainly with the mayor referendum, a period where there was no CCTV coverage of the ballot boxes here, and it looks like something similar may happen. What happens now is you have the votes overnight, the ballot boxes are kept somewhere, and then the vote starts in the morning. What are your thoughts about that? Because in the old days, they used to just literally start the count as soon as the people had cast their votes and the ballot boxes were closed here in Britain.
Yes, I don't think that that election fraud is as big a problem in Britain as it is in the United States, although, of course, historically, in places like the six counties of Northern Ireland, it was an issue. I think the real danger with our election for police commissioners, and since we're discussing police commissioners, is the turnout is likely to be less than 20% across Avon. So whoever wins was going to win on a fraction of the electorate supporting them. And what mandate will they have to deal with thorny issues like the responsibility for a riot situation or what have you? I think the real danger that we've got is that politicians aren't actually in control, that forces beyond their control are already pulling us in various directions, and politicians run along in their wake.
Okay, the UK tells the US you cannot use our bases to attack Iran. In a legal judgment last week, Foreign Office and Ministry of Defence lawyers concurred with the Attorney General in deciding it would be unlawful for the US to use their UK military bases for a preemptive strike on Iran.
Well, I think that's extremely interesting and very welcome if the legal eagles at the heart of the British government have decided it's illegal to attack Iran. It was illegal to attack Iraq, which is why people are calling for Tony Blair to be sent to The Hague and all the rest of it. But I think it's absolutely clear an unprovoked attack on Iran without a UN security resolution is illegal. And if Britain participates in that, the Iranians will be absolutely within their rights to fight back as hard as they can. And people have also got to realise that the Iranians are not defenceless. And if it comes to a fight, it's not guaranteed that the West will win.
Now, Britain's serious fraud office is being seen around the world as something of a soft touch. How do we know that? Well, German arms firms set up a London subsidiary recently after being fined €150 million by the German courts for bribery. The idea being, if those bribes were paid through a London firm, they could escape prosecution. Author of Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, Andrew Feinstein, spoke to me just before he gave a lecture at Bristol University earlier this week on this subject.
A company based in London in Mayfair called Marine Force International, known as MFI, created by two German companies, including Ferrostal, one of the most active of Germany's defence companies. The purpose of this vehicle, based in London, I repeat, is to reduce the company's exposure to both tax and prosecutorial risks in Germany. In other words, it's been created to funnel activities of the company that it doesn't want German law enforcement authorities or tax authorities to know about. Now, what is additionally worrying about this company is that a key role it seems to be playing is to assist not only its parent company, but also other defense companies to pay commissions. Now, commissions are sometimes legitimate payments to intermediaries in arms deals, but the vast majority of time and the vast majority of money, they are what you and I understand as bribes. And this company does that through the creation of what are called economic offsets. which is a mechanism in very simplistic terms whereby a defense company says, if you buy $100 of my weapons, I will invest $120 or $140 or $150 in your economy. Now, those economic investments are very, very seldom realized. But the offsets are a crucial way in which to bribe key decision makers on arms deals. So, for instance, in a deal I try to investigate as a member of parliament in South Africa, the defense minister at the time, who was the key decision maker on a $10 billion arms deal, had shares bought for him in a company that he joined the day after he left government. That company received quite literally tens of millions of pounds worth of so-called offset contracts from the British company BAE Systems, and BAE were awarded a contract that the South African Air Force didn't want them to have. It didn't want the trainer jet that BAE was supplying. And this is the way in which these economic offsets are used. So this company, MFI, despite Ferrostal in Germany having been fined 149 million euros for over 1.1 billion euros of questionable payments in a whole range of over a dozen companies around the world, two of their directors getting suspended for what are described in the law reports as questionable payments, this company, MFI, which was involved in a whole lot of those deals, continues to function and flourish in the United Kingdom with no trouble from law enforcement authorities at all. This is exactly the sort of company that we need to be clamping down on if we're going to clean up the global trade in arms.
Now, just for the benefit of the Serious Fraud Office, what are the names of those two German companies again?
The first company is called Mann Ferrostal, an extremely well-known large corporation, and the second is called HDW. And this information will be presented to the director of the Serious Fraud Office.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
That was Andrew Feinstein, author of The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, talking to me at one of the Bristol University lecture theatres earlier this week. Now, Martin, what he's saying effectively there is that these German businesses have got caught red-handed at home. They've been fined, prosecuted, and they've decided that London is a bit of a soft touch, so they'll set up a company in London to do this dirty work for them, and they don't think they're going to get any kind of prosecution here.
Well, I mean, Britain has got a reputation for being the place where you come to do dirty arms deals. I mean, British Aerospace has, you know, is one of the biggest arms companies on the planet, and the Al Yamamar defence deal with the Saudis was one of the biggest and most corrupt deals that was ever done. And when we talk about the corruption in third world countries like Saudi Arabia, what we often fail to mention in our media is who's corrupting them. That would be us then. And of course, here in Bristol, that is us, because we've got BAE Systems based here.
OK, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, thanks very much. Now we're going back to join our four police and crime commissioner candidates with a police story. To begin with, we'll talk to Ken Maddox, who's the Conservative candidate, on this particular news story today, which is the Metropolitan Police getting £22.7 million from sponsors. The BBC Freedom of Information request has found the figures being disclosed. Donations ranged from football shirts provided by Queen's Park Rangers and Chelsea to motorcycles and cars supplied by Land Rover, BMW and Nestle, right the way through to vast sums of money going to help from the city to go to help combat card crime. Ken Maddox, what are your thoughts about this idea of the police taking millions of pounds in sponsorship? Is that the right way to go?
I don't know. I haven't heard the story, so I don't know the details about it. All I've heard is what you've told us in the last 20 seconds. It's something to be wary of, but I don't see any reason in principle why it shouldn't work, as long as it's properly policed.
The BBC Home Affairs correspondent Danny Shaw said the figures provided an insight into some of the less well-known sources of income at Britain's biggest police force. Between April 2007 and March 2012, the Metropolitan Police received at least 833 donations, with a number of police stations and units across London being the beneficiaries. Pete Levy, you're the Liberal Democrat candidate for the Police and Crime Commissioner. What are your thoughts about sponsorship of the police from outside businesses?
First of all, sponsorship of the police, as with Ken and the Met. I don't know the specifics of that particular story, but I think that with regards to the police and crime commissioner, it's the commissioning element, and I think that, you know, it's not just policing, but supporting all the voluntary organisations across Devon and Somerset, such as the Bristol Drugs Project, and I think if we join together collectively, we can raise our individual profiles and support the work they're doing. If that means that we've got to look elsewhere for funding to support those type of projects, then I believe that we should do exactly that.
John Savage, you're the Labour candidate. An oil security organisation helped pay for a police constable to reduce crime at petrol stations, and the record company EMI donated 11 concert tickets. These are the kinds of sponsorship that we're talking about.
It's an extremely dangerous area to stray into. Whatever the demands we have to balance the books, this is not the way to go. It's opening the police service up to suspicion, and I don't think it should be allowed.
Sue Mount Stevens, you're an independent candidate. This is clearly a growing temptation for, if we can put it like that, for police forces as budget cuts are brought in. What are your thoughts about police sponsorship from private businesses?
Well, I haven't heard the story before, or not in this depth. I think we have to be careful, but I think we, as long as we are open about where the money is coming from, and make it very clear. I can certainly see some of the attractions maybe for, I'm just thinking of maybe Broadmead, maybe contributing, all the shops in Broadmead contributing towards PCSOs. So I can see, I suspect that that would come under the same sort of sponsorship. And with the cuts that we're going to experience, maybe that's something we could look into. But I think with all these things, we must not do anything that is not very, very transparent. So I would want to make it very clear. But I think, like John, we've got to be very careful that we don't get down the route that we have one police service that is being paid for and only then serving those needs rather than the whole of the population.
I mean, this case is a bit cheeky of me to tell you, because this is a new story that's just only broken today. But, you know, we are in a situation, John, you had something to add, didn't you, about Broadmead, I think.
Yes, well, because I was the chairman of the Broadmead board for 20 years, and we had a patch where we were invited to, and we did respond from our limited funds, to pay to increase the police presence in Broadmead, and it helped a lot. We there was big crime reduction. But of course the spin-off of that is the question, Sue's covered it, do you only get good policing where you can pay for it? Especially, are only rich people going to be able to have the best policing? It's not on.
I'm going to mention EDL and EDF in the same sentence there, because I think that we had the EDL marches recently, and there was uproar from a huge swathe of the public who said it cost an awful lot of money. Who's going to pay for that? And we've got EDF potentially in Bridgewater. That's going to bring an awful lot of pressure to bear on policing. Who's going to pay for that? I would look for them to pay their part. That's not sponsorship, but actually that's paying. And then if we also take policing around football venues as well. Clearly, you would expect the clubs to make a contribution for policing those venues. So I think it's about checks and balances, but sponsorship is a completely separate issue.
Right, well, let's move on to a different topic, and this one is to do with accountability and interests. And for many people, including myself, it's a concern that Freemasonry plays a role in the police. The black and white checkerboard things you see around the side of some police vehicles and on a lot of police literature are exactly the same as the carpet that you see in the middle of the Masonic temple. So there may be a little bit of certainly there's a lot of suspicion around this anyway. I wonder, maybe we could start with you, Sue, about how you make sure that if senior police officers are, and I've spoken to some fairly sort of PCs, they are concerned about this, to make sure that they are declaring their interests if they are a Freemason and a police officer at the same time.
Well, I'm obviously not a Freemason. And I think there has to be a registration. Certainly as a magistrate, you had to register whether you're a Freemason or not. And I assume it the same must be for the police. But I really don't know much about it. But I think belonging to any organisation that could possibly be of an interest to the police, you must be very, very careful. And I think certainly for a PCC, I think it would be relevant not to have any vested interests in any clubs or organisations.
Because, I mean, it's basically about good governance, isn't it? You declare your interests, and for a lot of Freemasons, they don't do that.
If you're telling me that that's what they don't do, then certainly...
Well, they don't have to, anyway.
Okay, well, I mean, certainly I would expect any police that, you know, should be able to declare their interests. But I don't know enough about this, Tony.
John Savage, Labour candidate, what are your thoughts about Freemasonry? Is it an issue? And should the police be forced to declare it?
I think there's a general expectation that people should declare it. I mean, it's a mystery to me and slightly odd. I do know, you know, I know something about it from a long time ago. I must say that I've always been bemused at the thought that these people are getting up to dreadful, dreadful conspiracy. But it's your opening comment was an attack on me slightly of being a merchant, wasn't it? You know, I don't have to declare it because everyone knows I'm a merchant. I'm the only socialist member of the Society of Merchant Adventurers. I have declared it, but, you know, there's a bunch of really decent people, men and women, who, whatever the past was, you know, one of my great heroes is Julius Caesar. You know, how far back do we go? Pax Romanus was an interesting arrangement. Join in with us or we'll kill you. You know, that was interesting. But... Yeah, I think that where there may be shadows and doubt, then there should be a declaration.
Pete Levy, what are your thoughts about this? Do you think it is an issue or not? Because ultimately, you know, anybody who's in a senior position surely should be declaring any outside interest.
Do I think it's an issue? No, I don't. I mean, I've been a Bristol City Councillor only for 2.5 years, and I've been a member of the Police Authority for the same length of time, so we've had to declare our interests. I think, you know, police officers, police staff and volunteers, they've got certain codes and guidelines by which they have to operate. And if there's any doubt, any belonging to any organisation or whatever it is that actually impedes their ability to do their duty, then I think it ought to be questioned. I did get an invite to a Masonic function 4 years ago from an old army colleague of mine, and it was an event to raise funds for the hospital that looked after his terminally ill daughter. Now, that sort of event, for me, that's not going to bring anyone's qualifications into question. No, specific to the Masons, no, I don't think so. I think everyone ought to be judged. If they step out of line and they're not able to do their job properly because of outside influence, then that ought to be dealt with.
So should officers declare whether they are Masons or not?
I would probably want to have a conversation with Strategic Director of HR and the Chief Constable, because if you say yes to Freemasons, where do you stop? Are there other organisations, member of political parties, are there other organisations that they need to declare that interest? I'd probably take advice on it, to be honest.
Ken Maddox, Conservative candidate.
Well, I'm not a Freemason, I never have been. I've no intention of becoming one. In general terms, I think if people are members of things, they should not be ashamed to say so. So I don't oppose declaration in that sense. I admire your ingenuity, I must say, in suggesting that the pattern around a policeman's hat is somehow connected with Freemasonry, and I suppose they probably, you know, as it's black and white squares, they probably all play chess the whole day, do they? I don't know. So that was stretching it a bit far. But on the more significant openness agenda, I must say that we still have some way to go on making things much more open, and there are all sorts of reasons relating to accountability and honesty, but I'll give you one practical reason, and that is, especially now with budget cuts, we're going to have to ask more and more and more of the voluntary sector and people out there who are potentially able to help the police. Now, if we want them to help us, they need to know what we know. So we have to share the information we have if we're really serious about getting them to help us. I certainly am. I've gone on record as saying so and doing it in the past in my public life. And my inclination always is for the default position to be in favour of disclosure. We know that there's the odd occasion where you can't disclose if it's a highly confidential terrorist issue or something of that sort, then it becomes more difficult. But in general terms, the default position should always be in favour of disclosure, in my mind.
That was Ken. John, you wanted to come
well,
in?
Well, because, I mean, just thinking about business and other things in the hospital, every time we have a board meeting, there's a list of what we've disclosed, all of our interests. And if there's a new interest, the first thing I do is welcome the members to the board meeting. The second is, are there any disclosures you need to make? You know, it's part of routine. So you know, I think the danger associated with this is being overplayed. Mm.
Okay, so our next question is about poverty-related crime. One of the things we're seeing at the moment with austerity measures is various other things, new things are being criminalised. We've just had the criminalisation of squatting, with the increase of council tax payments for people who are on benefits who don't necessarily have the money to pay, and other kind of poverty-related crime. John, can you start on this one, please? How is it going to be your priority to make sure that the police aren't spending too much time dealing with this? Another problem here has been the closure of a lot of mental health institutes. So there are a lot of areas of crime where police are having to deal with basically society's casualties rather than actually to go out and actively, proactively sort out crime or tackle crime.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I've stated it in my book, and I've stated it in many meetings. I find the concept of poverty in this otherwise civilised country an abhorrence, and particularly in a place as potentially rich and actually rich as Bristol. So, and people suffering from poverty, suffering in horrible ways, really. So I'm against it, but I think there's a call in this job to influence other people. This is about working together. It's about getting the whole resource to work together. You're right about mental health things. I mean, we've got a woeful lack of care for people who are mentally ill. Pushing them out in the community was a grave mistake, in my view. We should have improved their services in other ways. And here is a role which will be significant, which covers a big patch, that ought to be able to have a say in the other institutions about how we deal with these things together. The police just, you sort of inferred it, the police have to mop up the damage after these things go wrong. It's not good enough.
Pete Levy, Lib Dem candidate, what about this aspect of the police in often dealing with poverty-related crime, where people just simply either can't pay their council tax, they're homeless, and so they're having to squat, and also the whole business of the increase in the amount of time police are spending looking after the mentally ill who aren't being looked after now in the welfare state?
Yeah, I think there is always an issue, is that the police are that last fallback position. I think that we've got to start asking local authorities to start taking that level of responsibility back themselves. I think it's two things. I remember when I was a young Bobby, is actually being called to a tramp, gentleman of the road, who was kicking off because he was demanding 6 months worth of pension. Actually, when I checked his ID, he was such a decorated soldier from the Second World War. I took him for a cup of coffee, and it was resolved. So I think that you do need to bear in mind that the fact that you're dealing with human beings, whatever their condition, and take that into account. But I think that the police ought to also look at policies. Now, I'd look to have a policy officer within the PCC office, because if there is an element of legislation that we need to readdress or we need clarification on, then we can do that immediately. And I think that around drugs, around squatting, if the police haven't got the resources to deal with it, then we need to put our hands up and say we haven't got the resources to deal with it.
Ken Maddox for the Conservatives, what about this poverty-related so-called crime and the increasing number of mental health patients who are out there on the streets the police are having to deal with?
It is a really difficult issue, isn't it? And I do recognise that. And I do agree with much of what's been said around the table, and that the police do tend to, you know, pick up their pieces when nobody else is there to do it. And many of the things they do are, you know, done for the best of motives and the most humane of reasons, but it really is not a police job. And many of the people they deal with need actually treatment for mental health or drug addiction or other problems of that sort. So it is a complicated problem. I'm very aware of it myself, personally, as having been the first chairman of the new Health and Wellbeing Board in Somerset that brings together the local authority and the National Health Service. And as Police and Crime Commissioner, one of my first calls will be to that board, because they're the three players who can make a significant contribution to reducing this awfully complicated problem of poverty-related crime. I've also been a director of a newly formed social housing company with over 4,000 houses. So I'm well aware of the good work that can be done to help with this. Only this morning I was visiting with the Addiction Recovery Agency in Bristol, opposite the Old Vic. And I do know the good work that they do in helping people out of their problem on a long-term and sustainable basis. And that is one of the ways that I would, to go back right to the very beginning of what I was saying, that is one of the things that I would seek to do in order to reduce the level of crime. You know, people slip up, they make mistakes, they have a difficult time, they cannot just be swept under the carpet. There will be a future for them, but it will be different from their past, and we have to help them to find that future.
Yes, I don't think we want to end up in a situation like it is in the United States, where so many of the people in the prison population are actually just there because they are poor, have got into organised crime and that kind of thing. Sue Mount Stevens, you're an independent candidate. What are your thoughts about this business of mental health and poverty-related crime?
I think the issue, particularly with mental health, having been on the monitoring board at Bristol Prison, it is absolutely key in the fact that there are many who end up in prison because there is nowhere else for them to go. I would agree with the others that the police are the safety net. They're the ones who get called out at 4 a.m. or, you know, on a wet Tuesday morning, when there is no other agencies that can look after those people who are mentally ill. Now, we only have two beds in Bristol. These are for people who have been who are mentally ill and who have committed no crime, and therefore, once those two beds are full, then they have to go into a police cell. Now, that is absolutely ridiculous. It is not the place for those who are mentally ill. And I think we need to, as a police commissioner, I would work very closely with local authorities and particularly with the NHS, that we have much greater provision, because two beds for the whole of Bristol, and I think that includes also North Somerset, is just not acceptable. We need to work far more together. Everyone is having cuts in their resources, and rather than just retracting back and almost looking after our core, we actually have to be far more open and drop down our barriers and see what we can do together. Because between us, local authorities, NHS, all the authorities, between us, we can be far more effective if we work together, not as if we try to compete with each other. And because then so many, particularly those who are poor and those who are mentally ill, they are going to fall through the cracks.
John, I think I ought to come back to you on this one, because you are a director of an NHS trust in the city. What can be done, do you think, to sort of liaise, if you become Police and Crime Commissioner, with the National Health Service to make sure that the police aren't spending their time picking up mental health casualties around the city and the country?
Well, I'm the chairman of an acute trust, so that provides immediate and intensive help. The health service is not a great single mass. It's a whole load of different things. It operates in different ways, and the ambulance service is separate, and the mental health service is separate. And I think there's something gone terribly wrong there, because some of us work 24/7, and some of us work 5 days a week, and sometimes you can get the help you need, or sometimes you have to wait until Monday morning. And Sue's right. You know, we don't have enough a beds, as it were, secure but comfortable, properly tended beds for folk who are essentially ill but are not essentially part of needing to go to the acute service. Acute is about, you know, immediate help with very serious illness. But so that we've let the mentally ill and the stressed down as a community as a whole, and that's largely because the financial pressures on everybody, local authorities, hospitals, other parts of the National Health Service, we've let them down. The public have got to come to terms with realising that if we want more stuff, we've got to pay for it.
Okay, now let's go to the other end of the scale and start with you this time, Sue. What about white-collar crime? Audit, accounting fraud, selling off police property at knockdown prices maybe, and to private developers, this kind of thing. Now, we do see quite a lot of derelict sites, old sites. We've got the old Bridewell in the city centre in Bristol. The other end of the scale from what we've just been hearing about poverty is that there is crime going on, there's fraud going on, and if you sell a bit of public property at a knockdown price to somebody, that's fraud. Can you start with just addressing that, and if you think that that could be an issue for you in the future?
Well, I think there's two different issues there. White-collar crime, that is, they have disobeyed the law, then that's a criminal offence, and that has to be processed by the police, go through the CPS, and they go to court. There is, no one is protected from that. But as far as the developing is concerned, I don't quite understand the issue. Could you explain?
Well, really, I'm talking about public property being sold off for knockdown prices, which essentially is fraud. I mean, that's potentially an issue. And is it possible to monitor that kind of thing? Because these are issues which seem to sort of slip through the net.
If it's fraud you're talking about, then that's very clear. Then that again is against the law, and that it will come to court. If you're talking about a view that authorities should not be selling off certain silver that belongs to society, then that is a very different issue. But just to remind you that, we're here as candidates for the Police and Crime Commissioner. We're not going to be able to change the whole of the culture of society. What we really must concentrate on is what the residents of Avon and Somerset and what they are telling us their priorities are. But there is no one that's above the law. Everyone should be treated the same.
Kim Maddox?
I don't see property sale as fraud, unless there's something more to it than what you've put to us. I think that's, if I might say, a piece of rhetoric, perhaps worthy of a politician, but I certainly wouldn't resort to it. White-collar crime is a crime, and it needs to be treated in the same way as any other crime. I'd like to reduce the occurrence of that crime, as I've said consistently through the evening. My objective is to cut crime, but where it's committed, there needs to be proper punishment, proper restitution, and proper rehabilitation to prevent it from happening again.
And Pete Levy.
I think the issue around about sale of property and disposal of property is probably outside of our pay grade. Having said that, if someone in authority commits a crime, and we alluded to it before, police officers or staff or whatever, then, as was the case when I was serving in the forces, you would expect to be dealt with in a harsher way because you're there to uphold the law and to show a good example. I think at the other end of the scale, I think to go back to the point we were talking about poverty, I think we have to deal with that in as sensitive a manner as we possibly can. I mean, that's not being soft on perpetrators. However, crime is crime is crime. But there was a story recently of a police officer who caught a member of the public shoplifting because they had no money and they needed to feed their family. And he took him to a food bank and didn't arrest them. That, for me, is a more sensible, humane approach in applying the law.
John, what about this business of white-collar crime and this sort of boardroom crime, idea that you might sell off something, a public asset, for less than it's worth?
You're onto dodgy ground here because you're inferring that you know something.
No, I'm not.
So you should be clear that you don't know something because look, I've just, as an example, we've just sold off the old General Hospital. We went through a process, yes, because it's closed. We're closing all of the old estate, thank God. We've sold it. And what are we doing with the proceeds? It's providing a contribution to the £100 million we're spending to develop the new BRI, the extension. There are all sorts of quite rigid controls about how you sell public property. And I think that your listeners need to know that and understand it, because you're inferring that there are people playing games with that. I think it's very difficult to do that. You've got to get the best price, and you've got to prove to all sorts of people that you've used it well. And that applies to local authorities, police service, National Health. So don't infer that. You may not have been being mischievous, but it's not right. And what's the other end of it, though? What's the biggest white-collar crime that has affected most people? £19 billion worth of bank money set aside because of the mis-selling of insurance.
Payment protection, yeah. Insurance.
That's crime. And that's a lot of ordinary folk who've suffered from it. Who's going to get put in jug for that? Nobody, I'll bet. That's crime. And then to a lesser extent, you know, the people with their fingers in the till, parliamentarians, again, even today, more people being caught doing the same bloody thing. That's crime.
And as I mentioned right at the very start, HSBC doing money laundering for the Mexican drug cartels.
To come back to the MP today who's been fiddling invoices. So not only has he been fiddling the invoices, he has been signing them off in, according to the papers, signing them off in a different name. And he's been suspended for 12 months. Well, in my book, that is just not acceptable. He should be dismissed and he should be taken to court, because he has committed a criminal offence and being suspended is not acceptable.
Now, Pete Levy, you're the Lib Dem candidate for Police and Crime Commissioner. You're a Bristol City Councillor, but the job entails a massive area. It's 1.6 million people are being policed by Avon and Somerset Police. How will you make a balance of some sort between what's going on in the countryside and what's going on here in the city? Because you don't really have the experience of the countryside.
I do. Sorry to disagree with that, Tony. I was born in a little village called West Coker, which is just outside Yeovil. When I first joined the police as a cadet in rural Wiltshire, I served in Corsham and Devizes, and my two biggest jobs were pig movement licences and shotgun application licences for market day. But you're right, actually. I made slight light of that, but in fact, that is the big issue for Avon Somerset. There is a fear amongst rural residents that funds are going to be drawn back into Bristol, but actually that's not the case. And I'll tell you why it won't happen is because Avon Somerset Police is broken up into districts with its own district commander. I would expect to have a member of the Police and Crime Commissioner's staff responsible per district, so that and working with local authorities, and they wouldn't let that happen, to ensure that that every area, every district gets the relevant level of effective policing right for its needs.
Ken Maddox, you're a country boy, aren't you, from Somerset? How would you bring expertise from the country and decide on priorities in the city here?
Well, there are some particular difficulties associated with the country, in particular, you know, theft of expensive machinery like tractors and so on for export, theft of livestock, theft of fuel stuffs, for example. And I've certainly spoken with countryside groups about that, and I have a great affinity with the difficulties they're suffering. Of course, there are crimes in the city centres as well, in Bath and Bristol and other large centres, and they all need to be addressed. I do have to note that about 41% of the police budget seems to go to about 27% of the people in the police area. Now, that may be right, and it may not, but I should want a pretty close, fresh look at that if I'm Police and Crime Commissioner.
So you're talking about, you think too much money may be going into Bristol?
That's a widely held perception outside of the city. I want to see if that's an accurate perception or not.
But isn't that simply the fact that there's more crime in the city generally?
It may well be. That may well be the conclusion. And I don't have a closed mind. All I'm saying is that a number of people hold that perception very strongly, and I will have a fresh look at it to make sure the balance is right. And I repeat what I said earlier. A crime is a crime wherever it's committed, and the victims need to be protected from that happening again.
John Savage, how will you get the balance right between policing the city, a very different type of job, to policing the countryside?
We haven't seen the budgets. I don't know. I don't know what the facts are like, Ken. I want to go into it in detail. I think it's right that we should look at districts, district by district, with budgets. But broadly speaking, the same funding should be allocated to each citizen. But there are repercussive effects of places, so that people who live in cities are not the only people that use cities, and we have to take that into mind as well. You know, quite a lot of people travel in from the countryside, so the maintenance of law and order and safety in a city is crucial to many other people as well. But you know, we've got to get the allocation of resource right for all of the people.
So,
having spoken to residents, particularly in Somerset, where an issue of metal theft is very important, there was an operation that the police have just done in June or July, I think it was, where they did go and investigate 280 places, and quite significant arrests were made and have come to court. And in fact, crime has reduced in that particular, metal theft has reduced by 50%. So, you know, when there is a priority, the police will go and tackle it. I think one of the things that I'm going to do is, as if I get elected as a police commissioner, is to strengthen the and protect the neighbourhood policing teams. And this is where, so that residents can almost can work out what their priorities are. And by allocating money to the districts, and the districts allocating money then down to the neighbourhood policing teams, I think in that way the residents will get a fair deal.
Okay, and I'll start with you again on this question, because policing is fairly secretive. You know, police stations themselves are very secure. Things sometimes go wrong in there. We've had, particularly with the Metropolitan Police, a lot of deaths in custody, thankfully less here in Avon and Somerset. But when things go wrong, how will you make sure that there is some kind of proper whistleblowing policy in place, and that when police officers do blow the whistle, as they are supposed to do in the old days, in the old films, when they actually blow the whistle, that they will not be sacked and not be victimised for doing that?
I think that's a very good point, and certainly talking again to groups of people, the two issues that people are quite concerned about is the amount of stop and search, where they think that's unfair, and complaints, where they think it's a closed shop, where the police seem to be appearing to be marking their own homework. And what I will do is introduce scrutiny panels, which will be open to the public to apply for, which will be run by the public, and they will scrutinise the statistics that are going on and the complaints that are going on within the police. They will report to me as the police commissioner, and then we will do a report which will be available to the public. I think it is very important that it is looked at, it is perceived as being a closed shop, and what it is we have to do is bring the public in to make it as open and transparent as possible. And in the same way that bringing the public in, we need to go out and engage far more with the public. And I think one of the roles that I will do is that we will have public meetings in each of the districts, and we will also engage far more in PACs, which are Partners and Communities Together. What I've already said is that I will be spending one day a week out on the patch, engaging with communities, engaging with groups, engaging with residents, so that I can actually hear what is going on at grassroots. It's very easy to sit in an office and not engage with residents, and I've already had, you know, on this campaign, I've already had numerous emails giving me information about what is happening, and it's really important that as a police commissioner you engage right down at grassroots so you know what's going on.
John Savage, you're the Labour candidate for Police and Crime Commissioner. How will you make sure that police, when they do blow the whistle on malpractice of one sort or another inside the force, that they're protected?
Well, it's about changing custom and practice, isn't it? But I can tell you this, if you don't have an effective, credible way of allowing people to make their comments to whistleblowers, as you put it, then you get it haphazardly and dangerously. So it's an essential part of modern running of organisations. People have got to be able to make their point and have their point heard without them being victimised. It's vital, because things do go wrong. And if you don't have it formally, you get it informally, and that never works.
Pete Levy, you're the Lib Dem candidate. You're also a councillor, candidate for Police and Crime Commissioner. What about whistleblowing? Do you think it's important? And if so, how will you make sure that it works?
Yes, yeah, last resort. I agree with the points that John made with regards to that. But I think that, you know, prevention, go back before that. I agree with Sue. The police authority conducts scrutiny with regards to, you know, dip sampling files against police, for example, calls into recorded calls into police centres to make sure that members of the public have been politely and effectively dealt with. If I were police and crime commissioner, I would put something in place that would replicate that. But also, you said about behind closed doors, look at the number of persons that are taken into custody. The police already have over 60 voluntary custody visitors that are allowed access to a police station 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to make sure that the guests, as far as they are concerned, are well treated, respected, and well looked after. But actually, that also protects the police officers there as well, to make sure that they're doing an effective job. And I'd just like to say thank you to those volunteers, and that will be continued. And all of those things make sure that the public have confidence that what goes on behind closed doors is being done properly.
Okay, Ken Maddox, Conservative candidate for Police and Crime Commissioner. Whistleblowing policy, do you think it's important, and if so, how will you make
yes,
it happen?
Yes, I do. I think it's a cultural issue, and it starts at the top. And one would hope there would not be any need for whistleblowing, but we all know in reality that there is from time to time, and there will be. And I would certainly encourage it. And I think you can see from my past record on the overall open data agenda that my preference is always for disclosure of information, and the truth needs to come out, as I think Barack Obama described it, as sunlight is the best disinfectant, and I think he's absolutely right. And I certainly pick up the cross-check, the sort of triangulation issue. We do need to cross-check it with the people and make sure the police priorities are the people's priorities.
That was Ken Maddock, who's the Conservative candidate for Police and Crime Commissioner. You've also heard this evening from Pete Levy, who's a Liberal Democrat, Sue Mount-Stevens, who's independent on the police authority at the moment, and also John Savage, who's Labour's candidate. It's time to sign off now, but that's just the start of your Friday night extravaganza. Up next is the music mix. Get ready to dial 0117 955 3721 next week, not this week. You have to wait for the typical topical Afrotopical show next week. I'm Tony Gosling, and that has been Friday Drive Time with the Police and Crime Commissioners.
BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.